Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Safari Conversations, the Singita podcast. I am Bernard Stichling and I am a guide at Singita Kruger National Park. Today, we're talking to a very good friend of mine, John Roth, about his advanced guide training, his love for geology, and the way he incorporates a deep reverence for nature into his work, better known as nature therapy for guides. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you, John. Please tell us your story and how you got into nature therapy and guide training.
Yeah, thanks, Bernard. I started in 1989 working with school children, and from the beginning, it was a strong desire to encourage these young people to care for the earth. And I've been trying to figure out ways of doing that and ended up guiding thousands and thousands of people of different ages. And I found certain particular interests have emerged over that time, a strong love for geology, a strong love for invertebrates, and as I've gone, I've realized that we walk alongside fellow guides, and I just want the kind of successes that I've had in my own guiding and environmental education work to be able to rub off onto other guides. And I also want to learn from other guides. I like to build a community of practice to mentor fellow guides like yourself, but also to be mentored by people like you. And the guide training has emerged then as a way of adding to this fantastic group of individuals we have in this country and further north into Africa who share nature with people and actually bring about significant change.
John, I'm reading more and more about the healing power of nature and nature therapy. It's nothing new, of course. Nature is not a luxury, it's an accessible force for recovery. You can actually connect with nature anywhere you live. You don't need to return to nature, it's a natural state already. But could you please tell us what it is and what nature therapy means to you? Because I know it's very important to you.
Yeah, it is very important to me, Bernard. In essence, nature therapy to me is taking people into wild places specifically to provide opportunities for the therapeutic value and power of those places to positively influence the people. At heart, I desire to see people healed and restored and made well. And I have seen over the last more than 30 years now of taking people into wild places that magic happens in the bush. Take people into a wild place. Do certain things, avoid other things, and therapy kind of happens. So, yeah, I've found that there's certain activities that you can do with a group that will foreground those therapeutic opportunities. I've learned that in various parts of the world where this kind of work is done, there's particular kinds of practices, certain sequences, certain ways of studying nature therapy to a more or less formal extent, depending on what part of the world you're in. So, I've tried to draw from these practices around the world and develop a set of activities, certain kind of steps that really I find helpful. I'm seeing a lot of people changed for the better through this nature therapy work, and it can be done in lots of different kinds of environments. So a bushveld environment, a forest, a wetland, open grassland, the mountains, the sea, every place has its own particular characteristic, and we can just help to build those connections between those places and the people that we guide, and the change emerges.
That's incredible insight, John. The safari industry is well established. Singita, for instance, was founded 30 years ago, and there are even older safari companies. But over the years, our guests have evolved, and so has the safari experience. This means guiding has also changed. Talk to us about the way you think guiding is changing.
Perhaps guiding is changing because when people come to these wild places, they're looking for more, and they may not necessarily know that they're looking for more. People look for great wildlife sightings, a sense of peace. They love to be entertained. They love to make new discoveries. They love to forge new relationships with people who love the wild. And what I'm seeing more and more is that there's a kind of longing in people, and sometimes it's hard to put words to that. But I know that when you include in a guided experience, ways for people to connect deeply with place. The kinds of responses that happen indicate that there's a hunger in people that we don't necessarily see, but it's so obvious that it's there. So that means that the way we guide might need augmenting from time to time. And I certainly know for myself in my own guiding work that there have been some interesting learnings. And one of them is that I've found that I don't need to say as much as I thought I needed to say. Sometimes we can almost get in the way of a powerful experience. where guests are feeling a deep connection with place, and then too much information actually spoils that. So there's the sense in which we can unexpert ourselves and remove ourselves from the equation to an extent and allow the place to speak directly to the guests. So I like to try to connect people directly with place through different kinds of listening, through noticing the movement in a landscape, through focusing on particular kinds of sounds. Bernard, what about you? What have you seen in terms of change in the guiding landscape during the years that you've been involved as a guide? And I know you've had broad and deep experience.
So when I started guiding 12 years ago, John, who I was as a person and my reasons for coming to the wilderness and immersing myself in nature, nothing there has changed. The feelings have not changed. Quite a few changes, I would say, have occurred since I started to guide. More technology, less presence. People are there, but they're not. They're lost in the ocean of technology and attention. People's attention spans are not as long as they were when I started guiding, I feel. And that directly ties into the constant being on their phones or being connected through the internet to something else. So I've often found that it can be harder to reach guests, and the instant gratification is definitely a thing. So what helps that is moments of silence, I found. Switching off the vehicle, if you're on a walk, finding a quiet place to sit down, listen to birdsong, listen to the bush, wake up, and just not speaking, just realizing where you are, who you are, and not having a phone to read up on something or a message to reply to or listen to a song. Just being in the present and being surrounded by nature and just that. John, tell us about the science behind all of this and the effects that this has on the human brain and body, because I've read some amazing things.
I'd like to refer to what's called forest therapy or forest bathing in Japan. Shinrin-yoku is the Japanese phrase for it, and that's been happening in Japan for quite a long time now, several decades, and it has been rooted in quite hard science, actually. Medical doctors have been involved in this research and found that facilitated time in nature can actually lead to well-reduced stress levels, reduced cortisol, the parasympathetic nervous system is calmed, blood pressure is lowered, there's certain kinds of stress hormones that have been measured to have a lower level after a person has been in a natural place for a while. So there's a growing mass of measurable evidence that people need nature. And then I want to draw us to a little paragraph from one of my favorite books, which is The Lord of the Rings. And this is the focus on the color green, which we can miss this, but it's absolutely fundamental. We spend most of our time as a species in green places, and green has a calming effect. So here's J.R.R. Tolkien describing something that happens to people in greenness. At the bottom they came with a strange suddenness on the grass of Rohan. It swelled like a green sea up to the very foot of the Emin Mael. The falling stream vanished into a deep growth of cresses and water plants, and they could hear it tinkling away in green tunnels down long gentle slopes towards the fens. They seemed to have left winter clinging to the hills behind. Here the air was softer and warmer and faintly scented, as if spring was already stirring and the sap was flowing again in herb and leaf. Legolas took a deep breath, like one that drinks a great draught after long thirst in barren places. "Ah, the green smell," he said. "It is much better than sleep. Let us run." And that kind of sums up a powerful part of the work that I do, is just helping people gaze at greenness for long enough for it to actually touch them. It gets us out of our heads, out of this rational mind that needs to be busy all the time. And with the right kind of questions, the right kind of just putting people in a particular place or sitting and facing a certain direction, we find ourselves grounded in the present moment. And there's a sense in which we can play. We can be just purely present to the place we're in. We could pick up a small stone or start to rearrange some pieces of grass around us. It's somehow easier to smell a flower that's nearby. And I guess what I'm wanting to do is I'm trying to plant seeds of curiosity in people and a sense of wonder, which leads to a sense of hope. Because if you're curious, if you find nature to be a source of delight, and this really is a bit like being a child or going back to the childlike part inside us, then there's a sense of hope because there's always something new to discover. And, you know, at the heart of it, I guess I want people to fall in love with the earth. And my motivation there is twofold. I long for people to reconnect with the source. I believe that there's a deeper, more powerful creative source at the back of what we can see. And I long for people to have opportunities to connect with that. And I also want people to care for the earth, because we have a polycrisis, is how it's often described, a crisis of identity, a crisis of sustainability, a crisis of violence, economic crises of various kinds, all sorts of wars. And I mean, things can feel a bit heavy sometimes. I feel that when people fall in love with the earth, there's a power that they almost receive that gives them a bit of strength to keep going and tackle these various challenges. And then I also want to give people the opportunity to get to know the earth more deeply and how it actually works, the ecological functioning of our planet, this whole earth community that we are part of. And when that happens, people can better understand how to act, ways to behave that lead to ecological sustainability and a more whole earth community. So I've got lots of things that motivate me. Have you had any experiences where, as a guide, some of those magic things have happened while you've been with people? I'd love to hear about some of those.
All the time, John. My work is my passion, and I feel I'm here because I need this. I need to be immersed in nature from all sides, and I want to share this with people. I want to brag about the place that I work in. I want them to, as close as possible, feel the same way I'm feeling, be moved by the same color of a flower, the sound of a bird calling in the background. So these things happen all the time. I get excited because now I can share this with the people, and hopefully they feel the same delight and passion that I'm feeling. They will feel alive as I feel. And often if you and the guide and the tracker get excited, it's contagious. Guests just absolutely, to a certain degree, feel the same. There's so many moments I can think about. Moments that often stand out is any river setting, and especially that magical time just after the sun is set. Call it twilight, summertime, spring, even a bit into autumn, switching the car off in the river and just see the fireflies start to emerge from the reeds. And so many of our guests have such fond memories, quite often childhood memories of fireflies. It's a truly magical thing, a firefly. It cannot not blow you away, whether it's the first, the 10th, or the millionth time that you see it, maybe your last time you see it. I don't think most people can not be moved by it. So to listen to the flowing water, see the fireflies' lights switching on and off, hearing painted reed frogs calling in the reeds, casinas, another beautiful frog sound that I love, and looking up at the dark night sky and seeing the stars twinkle, it's absolutely pure magic. Sitting there for 10, 15, 20 minutes, who cares? You're lost in time. And before you know it, you've just melted into this landscape and completely become a part of it. And that changes people. I've seen that. It's a complete letting go of everything in the outside world and just being as present as you can ever be. That's what we strive for. That is what we love to see and that we love to do and we love to be a part of.
Thanks for sharing that. I could feel the experience. It's almost as though I was actually there.
So what if you're not particularly into yoga, John, or meditation or sitting in silence? Why do you think this would benefit me on safari?
Yeah, I think a lot of nature therapy practice can feel unusual to a person who thinks in more structured and linear ways. And a lot of folk who come on safari don't relate to just sitting quietly and doing nothing. One of the things I like to do is to just introduce slightly different ways of looking at something that's familiar. So somebody regularly comes on safari and, let's say, for example, keeps a well-maintained list of birds and is looking to add 20 new species on this particular trip. And it could be counterproductive if I'm saying, well, let's just is just sit and meditate for 20 minutes. So what I might do in a situation like that is, it's quite subtle. You're really trying to read the group of people that you're with. So there might be someone who is really interested in the birds and somebody else who would like to sit quietly. Is I might do an activity where we close our eyes and we just count on our fingers the number of different bird sounds. And I might just introduce in this situation the idea of the musicality of bird sounds. So it's an opportunity for a person who is recording the different bird species that they want to spot. It's an opportunity for them to note the different species that they're hearing, but also to perhaps pick up on the musicality of that sound in the landscape. And for the person who is more free about their way of experiencing nature and not particularly interested in noting all the birds, then it's a great opportunity to, I suppose, delve deeper into the idea of the bush being musical. So I think the benefits come as you read the group and you try out some different activities and you're watching all the time to see, is this working for people? Is this bringing that spark into people's eyes? Is it helping the people to be happy in this place?
On one of the many walks that we've been on before, what would you do at a stop?
I think for this, we're going to need to imagine being on those magnificent granophyre ridges that we love so much at Sangita Lobombo. And we've got a group of people with us. Wow, what a privilege just imagining this. I'm feeling like I'm there already. We're going to sit and close our eyes and just hands on that lovely warm rock. And just lean on it and feel the comfort of that rock and the way our body settles into the shape of it. And then, depending on the group, I might actually just get folk to reach down and touch some of the plants that are growing nearby. I will, of course, check that there's nothing dangerous there. But just to rub some of those leaves between their fingers and then to smell their fingers and just pick up the scent of the place. And then that might lead into a time for listening. So that activity I described earlier where we're listening for birds, just noticing the particular sounds. And then when your eyes are closed, you're much more attuned to sound and location. So you open eyes, don't say anything, and you're trying to see where that sound comes from. And it gives you a kind of 3D perspective of the place, where the birds are. And at this point, I don't need to name the birds in particular, unless a lot of folk in the group are really interested. But I suppose what I'm trying to do at that point is to give an opportunity for people to connect with the place at multiple levels. We might walk for a while after that exercise and come to a tree. And there's such magnificent trees on those ridges, as you know. And I think I might take us to one of those beautiful pod mahoganies and just stand underneath it for a bit and look up. Something that I love to do is to actually get people to see if they can find the shape of the first letter of their name in the branches of the tree. And so as they're doing that, they're looking for something that's familiar, but they're noticing pattern. They're noticing shape. They're actually, in a way, and I say they, but actually I'm totally involved in this and going along with the people as we do this. We're noticing fractals, these repeated patterns in nature that you so often see in the branching of a tree. And just looking at fractal patterns is actually beneficial to the human brain and the way it works. It helps us to calm down a bit because from a long-term perspective, having spent most of our very long history as humans outside, we're very used to seeing those shapes and those patterns and those designs, and they help us feel safer, like the color green. There's something about birds there as well. If you hear lots of different bird sounds, you actually feel safe because lots of birds around you suggests that big predators are absent. Bernard, that's a little adventure for us. And now we're going to get back on the vehicle. And I'm going to take us to some elephants. We've been driving and we come across a big breeding herd of elephants. And I mean, how might a nature therapy focus within a guided drive differ from a normal drive? It really so depends on the guests. But let's say my guests are open to the kinds of things that I've been talking about in the last few minutes. I might just try some questions. I might encourage people to imagine that they were right up close to that elephant. I don't like to get close and invade their space, but in our imaginations, we can travel there. Remembering our hands on the rock and how that felt, those textures and the way the temperature of the rock sort of bled into our fingers. Imagine that your hands were on the side of that elephant, running down the side of that elephant and feeling that gritty mud on your fingers. Imagine you were touching that tail. And what might those beautiful tail hairs actually feel like? And at this point, Bernard, perhaps you take the elephant hair bangle off your arm and invite those people who are clearly moved by this experience to feel what elephant hairs actually feel like. What else would I do? You know, I might at that point just throw in a little sense of the deeper connectivity of things and say, let's just take a closer look at those tusks on that elephant in the front there. They've seen a lot of adventures, if you like. You know, they're cracked and the tip of the one is worn and the tip of the other one slightly broken off. Looks like it might have been fairly recent and there's some green stains on there. And I just want you to think about how those tusks were actually made in that elephant's body, that they were built primarily from calcium. And that calcium came from the plants that those elephants were eating and many, many hours a day. As we know, elephants eat. So that's a lot of plants. And those plants have their roots in the soil right underneath where our vehicle is. And there's so much calcium in that soil, which has actually come out of these rocks. And here's one that I'm holding in my hand. You're welcome to feel it. Yeah, pass it around. Let's all have a good look at this. There's a whole lot of calcium in that rock. And when it decomposes, goes into the plants, the elephants come and eat the plants and build their bodies with that very calcium. So you're holding future potential elephant in your hand right there. It's like the rock is a seed that might grow into an elephant one day. Yeah, Bernard, that was quite an interesting journey. What do you think about that?
I think that was incredible, and I could feel myself there with you and actually witnessing it. It's amazing what a bit of imagination can do. And yeah, I can relate to many of what you do. Elephants just especially give you so much to work with. You know, personally, in low light conditions, featuring in all the things that I love, to see elephants is one of my most favorite times to see them, when they're not completely visible, when there's maybe just a bit of moonlight shining on them, and you have to rely on your imagination a lot to visually make out what they are doing, their shapes and sizes. And you rely more on what you can hear, you know, the trunk quilling around a branch, the tusk getting wedged under the branch, and with that joint effort pulling the branch off, and then the chewing, the rustling of the leaves, a bit of rumbling flatulence in the body, you know, it all adds to it, and it just makes it so more alive that you don't have the full picture and you rely a bit on different senses. And the subtle and not so subtle difference in their behaviors and when the sun is down, it's an incredible thing to see and experience.
I could hear, as you were speaking, I could hear that elephant chewing and a bit of tummy rumbling. And yeah, it's time for us to be back in the bush together again.
Couldn't agree more.
I wanted to speak about the water thing, because one of the things I've found in researching the nature therapy work is, and it, you know, actually saying the word nature therapy, it almost feels like a label, and it's kind of deeper than that. You know, it's like words sometimes get in the way, but there's a value in just gazing at water, the ripples, the way it moves or doesn't move. There's these kind of patterns that move in water that are much deeper than the busy rhythms that so many of us get caught in our day-to-day lives. And the water settles us at a deep level. The sound of falling water, you know, that place where there's the river crossings and we hear that water flowing past us. And if you stop the vehicle in one of those places, the sound of that water is, it's cleansing for the spirit. Gazing at the ripples moving where the crocodiles just come up. Just awareness of this ancient presence in the crocodile and the slow movement of that ripple as it drifts away from the crocodile, and our mind starts to slow down and travel with that ripple, and we become present to the place, to the situation, and we can carry that sense of presence and being more happy in our bodies in a particular place. We can carry that with us when we leave a sighting like that.
John, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed chatting to you today from Singita Kruger National Park, and it brings back so many lovely memories of our time spent in the bush, especially our walks and the granifiers especially.
Bernard, I'm thinking, so that last walk we went on, where we were walking single file, quiet, the grass is quite high, and we're weaving between those boulders and your shoulder brushes against them. You feel the size of them. I felt like we were in the presence of something bigger than ourselves. It was safe. It was almost like the walk was a little portal into a different time, outside of time or something, like a glimpse of the infinite. Yeah, that was like a sacred moment for me.
Absolutely. That's why I feel myself drawn back time and time again to take guests for a walk in the Granafire Ridges. There are lots of areas to walk here, but nothing quite as remarkable, as ancient, as timeless, as magical as the Granafire Ridges. You know, John, what I have found is that a lot of guests come here with very specific ideas about what they want to see, what they want to get out of the safari experience out there. And it usually revolves around the big five, you know, lion, leopard, rhino, elephant, buffalo, all the big things. And then you find once you're out there and once you do things like listen, touch, smell, feel, you know, people start to realize that there is so much more than just the big animals, even so much more than the medium and smaller size animals. There are beautiful rocks. There is the glint of sunlight catching a piece of agate that has been exposed to the surface. You pick it up, you feel it. You look at the contours and the lines, the gray-blue colors, the darker colors, and you wonder, how on earth is this even created? How can something so beautiful like this exist? You switch off the car and you tell everyone, look up right above your head, and you listen. You can hear a call of a martial eagle. And it takes you a few seconds to find it because it's flying so high up at temperatures that are much cooler than it is on the ground where you are. And you just see a tiny dot and hear it call. And you know that it's on the lookout for a monitor lizard or guinea fowl. It's looking for food. It's hungry. And then guests start to notice how much more there is, how it's about a whole environment, a whole ecosystem, that animals are really just one actually small facet of all the cogs that make this big, natural, beautiful green machine move. That everything is connected somehow, whether it's a pebble, grass seed, dead leaf of a tree, a butterfly flitting, flowers getting pollinated, the sounds mean different things. And it's music, you know, who doesn't love music? And that's exactly what sounds are in nature. It's a soundtrack. And the soundtrack differs throughout the whole year. You know, the sounds in the background in summertime is going to be very different to sounds in the wintertime. There's so many different grasshoppers and locusts and bell crickets and frogs and toads. It's music, and music moves people.
I'd love the opportunity here to speak to music and moving people, because moving people is one of the things that we want to do with our guiding. For me, it's not enough to simply entertain people. My desire is that people are moved by place, that there's a depth of connection, an emotional bridge that's built through experiences just like those that Bernard described, where people's hearts are touched and changed by being in the place. This is really the heart of nature therapy and guiding, is moving people. Bernard, thanks for this conversation. It's been precious, and definitely like being together in the bush again. And I'm really looking forward to when that can happen as soon as possible.
Thank you, John, for making the time. Hope to see you back here soon.
So I'd like to leave you with a poem that I wrote. I wrote this in the Waterberg about the kind of thing that these wild places do for us. A soul grows weary often. Here in the cage of busyness and image, expectations and the tired promise of a scrolled screen, the self gets tangled up in thinking, trying, pushing, frowning. We lose the real, clear thread. There is a welcome here, in the turning of light, a new face dawning into a million possibilities, a welcome in the words of birds spoken just beneath the surface of every clean, new song. The shape of earth, horizon lines inviting an imagined journey on the day's fresh edge. Sense, whispering that a listening body might respond. Stone that rests at the heart of landscape. Solid, sculpture, safe, an anchor. trees whose lifted arms delight the daylight, branches, fingers tickling sky. In such a place, a soul can grow outside a cage. Drift fingers of hope along a contoured edge, be drawn to light, explore, go singing free with every feathered voice, find soulscape in the landscape, swim into stone, leap on trees, reach out and occupy again its full and ancient home.
That was magical, John. Thank you. Wow. Thank you to our listeners for tuning into another episode of the Sangeeta Podcast Safari Conversations. Until next time.